Week 2. The Mercy of God. Words that wound, words that heal. Have you had those people in your life who have said things that you still carry around as scars? Maybe a coach, a relative, or other authority figure? Maybe a friend who wasn't thinking? In any case, words can do more lasting damage to the mind and the soul than just about anything. James 3 is pretty clear about that. Words that wound for the sole purpose of wounding are bad. People may try to dominate, belittle, shame, or dismiss another person with wounding words. And we all know what that's like. And be honest, we have wounded intentionally with our words sometimes too. But can words wound with the intention of healing? I had a professor in college named John Ford, not the famous movie director. He taught Shakespeare, and I did not have my head screwed on right at the time, and I made a D in his class. As an English major, that didn't look good. I think the D made him mad. He saw something in me and encouraged me apart from the other students. He called me into his office at the end of the semester, and he highlighted some things I had done that impressed him. He then held up my final exam with a big red D on it. In words that were meant to wound, he finished with, "This is a travesty of what you should have made in this class." Yes, he said travesty. Like I said, it was a Shakespeare class. His words wounded, but they were meant to get me off the dum-dum train that I was on and onto a path that did not include travesty. Words that heal can at first look and feel like words that wound. You've had that honest friend or spouse get real with you, not in rage, but in concern. Afterwards, you went quiet, probably looked like a duck that had been hit on the head. You knew what they were saying was true, even if you didn't want to come to terms with it right then. It sank in, and hopefully you repented and got off the dum-dum train. Here's something to tuck away when you're reading the Bible. God's words to His people are always meant to heal and bring us closer to Him. That includes Hosea. Healing words can be sweet and tender, like many in the Psalms and the prayers of Paul. Healing words can also be difficult and even offensive at first. But God never wounds just to wound us. If He ever does wound with His words, it's probably because we won't listen to a nicer way because we're persistent in rebellion and selfishness of some kind. In short, we're on the dum-dum train. So like with my Shakespeare professor, take the tough words from God for what they are. Healing words. Too far? Still, the words that God used here are about as frightening as His words get in the Bible. After Hosea and his adulterous wife, Gomer, had children, God gave them names Himself. Before we get into the names given to their children and what they meant, let's consider what naming children at that time often implied. As the old pastor once said of the difference between the legacies of the Apostle Paul and of the murderous Roman Emperor Nero, people name their sons Paul and their dogs Nero. What a name stands for, or after whom one is named, is important, even today. When naming a child, people look up what a name means in its original language, or consider the character of the person they might name their child after. That was true in biblical times as well, but names went even deeper than that at times. Sometimes a name was an appeal to God, a wish for the future, or a hope for something to come. The minor prophet Zephaniah was born in a tumultuous time, and the name his parents gave him means the Lord hides or protects. They were likely appealing to God to protect their son during fearful days. Genesis 5 records that Noah's parents gave him that name, saying, quote, out of the ground that the Lord has cursed, this one shall bring us relief or rest from our work and from the painful toil of our hands. Genesis 5:25. Noah means rest. His name was an appeal to God, a wish for the future, and a hope for something to come. A name could also be a negative thing in commenting on the loss of hope for the future or on a current event. When the Ark of the Covenant was taken by the Philistine army, her husband slain in battle, and her father-in-law fell dead in his horror at these events, a young lady named her son Ichabod before she herself died. 1 Samuel 4:21. The name means departed glory and was given because she believed the glory of God had departed from Israel in those terrible events. The name also cast that despair into the future, since the child would have that name his whole life and be a living commentary on the events that inspired his name. What God was doing in Hosea was something like this as well, giving a name that carried his decree into the future and personalized the decree in the sight of the people of Israel. But as we shall see, our redeeming God had more than just this in mind when giving these names to the prophet Hosea's children. His character shines through once again, but we'll get to that a little later. The first son God said to name Jezreel, which was the name of a valley near Jerusalem that had some things happen that deeply displeased God. You can read about an Israelite king, that's the northern kingdom. His name was Jehu in 2 Kings chapters 9 and 10. God raised him up in response to the nastiness of his predecessor, King Ahab, and wife Jezebel. Yes, that Jezebel. But it's possible Jehu took things a little too far and became more bloodthirsty than righteous in his actions. Biblical scholars did not agree on what God's, quote, punishment for the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel, close quote, in Hosea 1:4, literally means. The word itself means God sows. Now, I personally agree with the idea that Jehu abandoned the appointment of justice on the wickedness of Ahab and turned to relish the power trip and the bloodiness of it all. It's not pleasant reading. So, the next child born was a daughter. God said to name her No Mercy, for I will no more have mercy on the house of Israel to forgive them at all. Hosea 1:6. A third child was born. It was a son. And God said to name him, Not My People, for you are not my people, and I am not your God. Hosea 1:9. Jezreel, No Mercy, and Not My People. How do you come back from that? Those names seem final, harsh, and bitter. It's as though God had given up on them and abandoned them in his judgment. These wounding words were hard to take. But there's more here than meets the eye. Let's explore how in the next section. No wrong answers, discussion questions. Words can wound. We all know that. But words can also work towards healing. And even honest, wounding words can be meant to wake us up and bring later healing. Are you okay if God's words need to wound sometimes in order to bring us back to Him to find needed healing? Number two, how has God used honest words in the Bible or in a conversation with someone to get your attention and to get you back on track in your faith? God would not be good at poker. This statement sounds absurd, as though God would play poker with us. But to extend this silly metaphor, God is notorious for tipping his hand, as it were, and showing us his cards. He wants us to know him and be known by him. He wants us to know how much he loves us. Love is the gas in the engine of the Bible. It's expressed in many ways and in many different situations, but his love is always at the root of all he says to us. If we're living in ways that bring harm, broken fellowship, and violence, his love moves him to say what needs to be said and do what needs to be done to get through to us. Here's an interesting example of God's showing his hand, although a tricky one. In the unsettling verse about the daughter's name, No Mercy, in Hosea 1:6, the way the verse is written is a little strange. In most English translations, the whole verse reads, She conceived again and bore a daughter. And the Lord said to him, Call her name No Mercy, for I will no more have mercy on the house of Israel to forgive them at all. But I will have mercy on the house of Judah, and I will save them. Hosea 1:6 and 7. That surely sounded like he was done with the rebellious house of Israel. However, Hosea was an interesting fellow, and God tipped his hand here. The phrase, to forgive them at all, in verse 6, is a tough one for translators. Let me quote from an excellent commentary on Hosea by Duane Garrett concerning the trouble with this verse. The precise meaning of 1, 6c, and 7 is much debated. The main difficulty is at the end of verse 6, which the New International Version renders, that I should at all forgive them. This is a very questionable, and one might even say impossible, translation of the Hebrew. The most obvious reading of the line is, but I will certainly forgive them. This, of course, would be a complete non sequitur after the previous line, a pronouncement that God would no longer show compassion on Israel. Garrett, Hosea, and Joel. Was God saying here that he could no longer show compassion and mercy to his people Israel? After going through some of the problems this phrase causes translators and the solutions that don't quite ring true to the text, Dr. Garrett comes to the conclusion, we are thus left with the astonishing possibility that the text means exactly what it says. I will completely forgive them. How is it possible that Hosea, speaking for God, could in the same breath say, I will no longer show love to the house of Israel, and I shall completely forgive them? It is jolting, but it is not unusual for an author who routinely sets assertions about God's terrible wrath directly and without transition beside statements of his absolute love. The inconsistency is the language of the vexation of a broken heart. And it also reflects the mystery of a God whose ways are above our ways. Garrett, Hosea. Exactly. God's mercy, love, and compassion for his wayward people and for us rises to the surface of Hosea's book. While some may disagree with this reading of the text, it's hard to read the end of Hosea chapter 1 in any other way. And when she had weaned no mercy, she conceived and bore a son. And the Lord said, Call his name not my people, for you are not my people, and I am not your God. Yet the number of the children of Israel shall be like the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. And in the place where it was said to them, You are not my people, it shall be said to them, children of the living God. Hosea 1, 9 and 10. Those two radically different sentences are back to back. It's been the biggest thing for me to see in the Minor Prophets what God really wants for us from the beginning. To bless and not to curse. There was even a reversal implied for Jezreel that turned from a sowing of judgment into a sowing of bountiful harvest. Hosea 2, 21 and 22. If God has to drop the hammer, it's not because he is quick to anger. It's because we persist in things that hurt us and separate us from him. He doesn't write off that one wandering sheep and say, fine, go ruin yourself. I'll stay here with all the other ones who aren't such a problem all the time. He leaves the 99 to go after the one. Why? Because he loves us. So from a former wandering sheep that was lost and is found, stop doing stuff that hurts you and separates you from God. Repent and come back to him. He will outlast you. I can promise you that. He is patient and he won't give up. If he needs to bring the pain, he will. Or worse than that, he may allow you to lay hands on the idol you're running after, only to turn back and see the wreckage you've caused in the pursuit of what will not satisfy. Don't let it get to that. Quote, today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. Close quote. Hebrews 3:15. Powerful love. One thing I have also learned from the 12, as well as from experience, is that God is serious about sin. He hates it. He knows what it does to us. To twist and darken and ruin our hearts. He is no friend to prideful boasting. Just because love is at the root of the Minor Prophets doesn't mean to take God's words lightly. God surely did pour out his fearsome wrath on your sin and mine. He spared no judgment and turned no blind eye, left no stiff-necked sin unanswered. He poured out his wrath fully on his son at Calvary, instead of on you and me. Remember that as we go. God's judgment is real. Oh, but thank God, so is his mercy on you and me through Christ our Redeemer. In fact, the cross casts a long shadow into the Old Testament. Even here, in the pronouncement of no mercy, followed by the outpouring of mercy, we see what we deserve in our sin against God alongside what we receive through the finished work of Christ if we confess and believe. That makes me close my eyes and sit in silence for a good while. Where would we be if God gave up on us and gave us no way to return to him? Spend no more time wandering. Come home. No wrong answers, discussion questions. God wants us to know him and be known by him. He wants us to know how much he loves us. How did God show his love for you and me? By giving what we don't deserve through Jesus. Number two, if God has to drop the hammer, it's not because he is quick to anger. It's because we persist in things that hurt us and separate us from Him. What actions or attitudes help you hear the voice of Jesus each day so that you're less tempted to wander away from Him? Beauty from ashes. You've seen it. I've seen it. You may have lived it. In rage, lust, jealousy, fear, hate, or envy, we chase our impulses and set fire in our sin to a thought, emotion, or relationship, burning our world right down, rejoicing in the heat, excitement, and delight until the fire goes out and we are left in the ashes. That feeling is cold and terrible. First we ask, what do I do now? Then we get to, what have I done? How we approach that question is very telling. Hosea chapter 2 paints a grim picture of God's people, Israel, burning it down, so to speak, right to the ground. The grass was always greener elsewhere for them. The clothes other people wore were always nicer. Their neighbors' gods were more fun to worship, and there was money to be made in doing things the wrong way. God's words are strong and hard to read here. He makes it more difficult by using the image of a terrible mother whose children are asked by God Himself to choose to reject her and live a different life than hers, one that does not include travesty, to quote my Shakespeare professor. The wayward priests and political leadership of the day are painted as the raving mother in these verses. And the people of Israel were the children suffering under her ungodliness. God painted a broken family portrait to communicate what our rebellion achieves. That's a tough one. It hits home to some whose family life may not have been so great growing up. God's words are strong, but remember what is at the root of them, His good character and desire for our best. Quote, plead with your mother. Plead, for she is not my wife, and I am not her husband, that she put away her whoring from her face and her adultery from between her breasts, lest I strip her naked and make her as in the day she was born. Hosea 2:2-3. The language is deliberately explicit and sexual. In chasing after the perverted gods of the other nations, pursuing their money and status, and making themselves appear like the other nations in style and morality, God's people were equated to prostitutes in a spiritual and moral sense. Their culture had degraded into gross immorality, as the minor prophets made clear. Nothing was not for sale, we might say. God called the nations around Israel her lovers to highlight the shameful spirit behind that nation's actions. Quote, for she said, I will go after my lovers who give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax and my drink. Hosea 2:5. It's as though they were saying, I don't need you, God. I'll get what I need my own way. You call sin repulsive, but it gets me what I want. Prone to wander. Let's not be too quick to judge here. Look at our own culture. How blind can we ourselves be? Of course things don't work out for the people of Israel, and in verse 7, they come crawling back to their first husband, God, after taking lover after lover, other gods, nations, to use the biblical picture. Again, God spoke with the words of a broken-hearted husband. She shall pursue her lovers, but not overtake them. And she shall seek them, but shall not find them. Then she shall say, I will go and return to my first husband, for it was better for me then than now. Hosea 2:7. God knows how sin destroys us. We've been walking this same crooked, sinful road as humanity for a very long time. It would be great if we could learn to stay near to the Good Shepherd and not wander into hurtful places. They don't look hurtful at the beginning, so we wander and we wound ourselves and break God's heart. But look at what God revealed here in the very next verse. And she did not know that it was I who gave her the grain, the wine, and the oil, and who lavished on her silver and gold, which they used for Baal. Hosea 2:8. That's pretty accurate. They were looking for what they needed in all the wrong places. We do that too. We snuggle up to a vicious enemy, Satan, who disguises himself as a provider and lover. We can tend to say that the good things only God provides came from somewhere else, or by our own ingenuity or influence. Then, when they are removed, we cry out to God with loud questions and come back to Him, only because we don't know where else to go. Ouch. James said to us that, quote, every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down to us from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. James 1:17. It is God, through Christ Jesus, who gives us everything we need for life and godliness. 2 Peter 1:3. The people of Israel in Hosea's day fell for a cheap substitute and a deceptive lookalike to God's abundant blessing on work, life, and family. Can you and I still fall for that same old thing? You bet. Is that where you are now or where you've been? Then come home. God looked forward in the next verses to the day when repentance was real and the return to Him wasn't just a stopgap measure. Look at what God said to His broken and wandering people and what He says to us now, not in wrath, but in deep compassion for us who are like sheep without a shepherd. And in that day, declares the Lord, you will call me my husband, and I will betroth you to me forever. I will betroth you to me in righteousness and in peace, and in justice, and in steadfast love, and in mercy. I will betroth you to me in faithfulness, and you shall know the Lord. Hosea 2:16-20. Right to the cross. Once again, God tipped His hand to show us what He really wants for us, relationship with Him. Look at the words He used in the above verse: righteousness, peace, justice, steadfast love, mercy, and faithfulness. Every single one of those is found for us in the love of Jesus. Get it through your head, as I get it through mine. What He wants for you and for me is relationship marked by righteousness, peace, justice, steadfast love, mercy, and faithfulness. Hosea brings us right to the cross. All of these things are lavished upon the children of God through the finished work of Christ for all who believe. In the Eastern mindset, especially of Hosea's day, the idea of household was what we might call family. It was more than that, though. Household included a wife, children, land, property, and livestock. In Hosea, all of these things were mentioned as being affected by Israel's sin. It's a good picture of how going down a wrong road doesn't just affect us. It affects those around us. A community on which we have responsibility and impact is damaged. We all have experience with this on many levels. How what we have done has affected those closest to us. It's an amazing fact to know that God is not some far-off idea, but is near to us and feels this way about us. In a torrent of emotion, Hosea revealed the heart of our redeeming God, who gives beauty for ashes and turns awful things around for our good if we will trust Him. God can redeem the whole household. But that work begins when we stop wandering and come home to stay with Him in faith. No wrong answers, discussion questions. In Hosea's day, the culture around him had degraded into gross immorality. In chasing after money, status, lust, and power, it doesn't take long for things that may have once been good to turn ugly and even violent. But God is gracious to call out the harmful patterns we may have developed personally or nationally. Describe where you may have seen others forget God and rather look around at others for acceptance, credibility, and identity. Number 2. Look back at Hosea 2:16-20. What God desires is a relationship through Christ marked by righteousness, peace, justice, steadfast love, and mercy. God can redeem the whole household that trusts Him, even if bad decisions have made things difficult for all who are close to us. What does the word Redeemer mean to you? Number 3. How have you seen Jesus act as Redeemer in your own life or in the life of someone close to you?